Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by. Welcome to the Talky Bit. I said I was going to say something about my reservations about the title. On the top of my notes, it says how to thrive through transition. On the screen and in the blurb in our public stuff, it's doobie-doobie-doo, thriving in transition. Not the singer, but the actual applied words to our lives. How do we do well in transition? How do we be well in transition? Those are sort of part one and two. But the thriving word is the one that I want to have just a little gentle push back about. I mean, this is really common in sort of the world of helping and self-helping. And right, thriving has become a word that's gotten a lot of mileage. I would say maybe in the last decade or so, in terms of the wider conversation about how we might do and be as people, we've started to use that word a lot. And we often use it as a bit of a contrast to, you know, just getting by, surviving. Thriving is different than surviving. And how lovely to think that we could thrive in and through transition. I think that's a lovely thought. And also, the pushback for me is, that's not always a very reasonable expectation. And so I want to mark that. I want to just say, you know, let's talk about thriving through transition. Absolutely, let's have that conversation. And look at the horizon of what could be, you know, because that's it really matters, and it can make a huge difference in our lived experience. And also, if we're in a transition that's a really challenging one for us, and just the presence of that word is enough to elicit an internal or maybe external eye roll, just know that you've got company. It's not always possible to thrive in and through transition. Sometimes we just are hanging on by our fingernails. In fact, sometimes just hanging on in transition is our moment of, that's us thriving. That's us really doing, or, you know, really doing as well as could be done. And so I wanted to take a couple of minutes with that. From a personal vantage point, this is my favorite season of the year, unquestionably, fairly consistently. And when the weather is, you know, sunny and bright in the fall, that's a delight to me. I don't find it difficult at all to say goodbye to high humidity and hello to cooler nights and the season where it actually feels good to sit beside a fire. You know, that stuff is delightful to me. That said, I have felt this September like the zeitgeist, at least as it showed up in the media that I tend to pay attention to, really seemed to be dominated by conversations about the challenges of transition. And some of that was really proximate. This is a time of the year where the things that are sort of wider social structures tend to kick into gear, and we feel the demands of those, especially if summer is a bit of a slower period for us. Old Mark Jordan song, what's the line? September marks my life out of time. It's just reflecting on his transition from his life as a student to his life post-student, and how this September was always like ka-chunk, right? It's the beginning of a different big part of the year. We're currently, as a household, we're down to one student, a university student, that's sort of firing things up this September. And they're a full-on adult. They're living away from home for the most part. So we're not exactly in the thick of that the way people who have school-age kids would be. But there's still a sense of transition, and not just the change of seasons, but that change of rhythm, that change in the day-to-day demands of life as work ramps up. I don't know how this works in your work life or in your life in general, but scheduling meetings in the summer, like why bother unless it's a crisis? But September, all of a sudden, all that stuff kind of seems to go on and lock. And then just to keep, personally, to keep things interesting for our household, because not so many kids in school, that was a little different rhythm for us anyway, because we homeschooled, but that was still a marker. But we've got a new puppy in our lives, and we got her when she was 8 weeks old. So it's a little bit like having a baby in the house, complete with nap times and this real frequent attendance to all things digestive. A delight, and also a demand. So change in rhythm, right? But even the big rhythms like season changes, back to school, I mean, they don't nearly account for all the transitions that we deal with, do they? Those are examples. We expect those big ones. We can sort of see them coming. But I want us to work a little bit with some ideas from a particular pre-Socratic philosopher this morning, Heraclitus, famously noted that nothing is permanent except change. Love that guy. And also, I want to acknowledge, given that this is a pre-Socratic philosopher, this is a Eurocentric lens on all these ideas. Other cultures would approach change very differently. It wouldn't be... It's only disruptive if we think that it's disruptive to some degree, right? If it's normalized or connected to other big ideas and values, then it feels different for sure. So I just want to acknowledge that, but that's the space we'll be in. So there's a popular illustration of this notion that nothing is permanent except change. It's also credited to Heraclitus. This sort of living metaphor that we never step in the same river twice. Right, that things are just always flowing, and even if it's like that's that name of that river, it's not going to feel the same. The contents of it are going to be different. There's always change around us and in us. I mean, right here in our own community, even the things we've talked about this morning, people are dealing with unanticipated, and in many instances, even if it's anticipated, deeply challenging transitions. Also, given the reason that we exist as a community, which is to make room for the exploration of beliefs, transitions are kind of the space we're always in as a collective. It'd be pretty tough, I think, to authentically explore what we believe if we're not open to being in transition. Those things like mutually exclusive spaces. To explore is to disrupt. To discover is to disrupt. And they're connected at the hip, I would say. And so we're in that space at the table. I think just the act of choosing to explore puts us in transition mode, especially, I would say, if we've been taught that right beliefs should be constant or unchanging, and that what it means to be faithful is to stick to what we believe no matter what, because it's unchanging. So, given all of that, I thought this might be a good time to just do a bit of poking around in what can help us as humans to both do well and be well, to thrive. Perhaps in times of transition, which, as I think I've just suggested, is all the time. So there we go. Let's start by defining our terms, because there's lots of ways we could think about this. For our purposes today, I'm going to say that a transition is any change in circumstances, whether that's personal, professional, societal, that shifts our status quo. By status quo, we might sort of also say our existing state of affairs. Kind of the way things typically are, right? So that's our working definition for transition. We've already considered some examples: change of seasons, back to school, changes in family structures, relationships, job changes, and then of course there's national and global affairs and wider societal shifts, right? The Canadian media's perspective, and most of us on this continent's experience to some degree, is that there are some significant transitions afoot societally. Globally, and we're a part of that conversation. So there's transition happening around us, whether we like it or don't, whether we have anything directly to do with it, or we just more feel like we're caught up in the tide of it, and we have to figure out how to deal. Those of you who know me and some of my core values will be aware that I'm not that keen on certainty. In fact, I think it's almost always wrong. It's almost always incomplete.
The only thing that is certain is that certainty is wrong.
We're going to get to exactly that, Jason. Yes, this, because Heraclitus, right? Like the thing that he said, only constant. Like, are you really not aware of the dilemma that you just created for yourself by saying the only certainty is change? Like, wait, just the words. You're certain that uncertainty is constant? Is that what you're saying? Like, it's a bit confounding. So for Heraclitus, this notion of the constancy of change was, if not an absolute certainty, than whatever's next door to it. Like, that's what the language suggests. He called it permanent. So speaking of change, he called it permanent. He also said that change was the most powerful law of nature and argued that, quote, our only security is our ability to change. Interesting. So for him, change was sort of the ground of all that is. It was the hub of the wheel. Now, we might not all see it that way, and there are some ideas that I think can reasonably temper the all or nothing of it, at least in terms of how we experience it. Change might always be happening, but we're not always conscious of change. We're not always aware. Sometimes that's a choice. Sometimes it's a subconscious response. It's self-protective. We're not going to look there, so to speak. It's too much. Our psyches are actually quite brilliant at protecting us. We don't always feel like it's brilliant when we're having to unpack it later, but you know, like there's some pretty big, to use a mechanistic metaphor, it's a pretty big machine operating there that we would label our subconscious in this regard. A change might be happening, and we might choose consciously to ignore or deny it. There's a number of different ways to measure this in terms of how our conscious subconscious functions. Lots of different viewpoints on this. Have I ever shared with you my favorite set of numeric, like my favorite set of numbers about this? Have I ever mentioned this in this setting? I won't get into the weeds of which study, big study, you know, meritus in its context, and they chose to use bits of information, however they were measuring those in the study, for how much our brains, this is a brain science thing, how much information our brains process in a second, and the big number was 12 million bits a second. There's lots of bits. So that's how much information is getting processed in a given second by our brains. So just for interest's sake, how many of those bits do you think are processed by what we would call in the subconscious conscious model our conscious mind? Out of 12 million, how many?
Probably less than
10%. Less than 10%? Yeah. You're on the right track. The number is staggering. It's 40. Not 40,000, not like just 40 out of 12 million. So 11,999,960 of those bits are being handled by a part of us that's real and impacts us, but we're not. It's not up here in the front office. We're not being aware of it. We're not turning the pages on that book. Like, that's all happening back here. I like to think of it as like a giant filing system where things just get slotted. And they get slotted because they look like something else, or they connect to something else, or they have an association, or they get dismissed as irrelevant, or they get sent to the front office to get it for us to have a look at, right? But 40 of them. So the front office doesn't have that much capacity relative to the back room, you know? And so even when we think about that in terms of that science, if you will, when we think about transition and how we experience it, so much of what's going on is not the part that we're overtly consciously thinking about. That's a powerful bit of math, among other things. So worth keeping in mind that when we choose to ignore or deny, that just means that one of those 40 bits kind of got processed and we said something conscious about it, but our subconscious might have already filed it or misfiled it. And my favorite illustration from my therapist friends, eye roll. But anyway, my favorite illustration in wider settings of what a therapist does is they help us go to the file room and find things that are maybe misfiled and go, that made sense that it went in that file in terms of history or whatever, but that we're not in that space now. So it could go in a different file, for example, you know, and that kind of work, right? So we're unpacking things that have already been packed away. Beyond that, some of us grew up around ideas of the divine, God, that offered some concept of unchanging as part of that picture. And there's textual basis for this, of course, in the collection that we call the Bible. God's the same yesterday, today, forever. And so our ability to apprehend that notion of unchanging, that's limited. And it is directly impacted by living in a world where change is a constant. Right? So that's kind of the pieces that we're sitting side by side when we consider this. We might also have been taught that faith was required, that the ability to believe in something that we could not see or directly know was essential because of our limited ability to apprehend the notion of anything that's unchanging. So that was kind of a gap closer in those idea structures. You need faith. Why? Because it doesn't actually make sense. Like, there's a gap between what we can apprehend here by seeing it, testing it the way we test things, and a belief that we have about something, perhaps. All of those ideas are predicated on choosing to believe certain things about the nature of God, and that's also not everyone's cup of tea. These days, we might encounter a saying like love wins, which suggests that the constant beyond all this change is whatever we're using the word love for, right? If love always wins, that's the constant. That's the thing that we're referring to as unchanging ideologically. Whatever we believe about what we cannot see, we have to find a way to navigate transitions. We have to find a way to learn to steer through them as well as we can. It really matters to our lived experience, and it makes a big difference to how our lives feel, among other things. And how our lives feel, it's not the whole story about how they are, but it's a really big chunk. How we feel about our lives is how we, a lot of ways, how we're experiencing them. So when we're in the thick of transitions, we might not be feeling especially reflective. So while we're here and in this explore mode as a collective, as a community, I want to just offer a couple thoughts about why navigating transitions well matters. We all know that they can be difficult. We're kind of hardwired as a species to steer clear of things that are difficult, at least things that are so challenging that they signal danger to us or to those that we care about or even to ideas that we care about. So there's a significant part of us that just wants to survive whatever it is that's disrupting our lives so we can kind of get settled and we can move on with what's next without that disruption. That's pretty natural. Wanting or needing to survive is not a small matter, and when I talk about thriving, I'm not denigrating that. And of course, we can approach transitions that way if we choose to. We can stop there. We can go, the way I choose to deal with transitions, I'm just going to get through it, and that's it. That's all I'm going to take from this. I'm just going to deal with the crisis and get that out the side door. Thanks very much. But I think there's more potential here than just the possibility of getting through it. Not always, but I would say, generally speaking, the potential is there. And so learning to navigate transitions well can lead to growth. It can lead to increased resilience. It can even lead to transformation. Or if we're not managing it as well, we can struggle through them in ways that cause stagnation and frustration and burnout and more difficult experiences. So in the interest of these transition parts of our life going as well as possible, whether we see them as a constant or not, because that's an idea, let's consider what some of the options might be. And I want to start by naming some of the psychological impact of transitions. We've already touched on the dynamic of certainty. So this might seem a bit obvious, but transitions cause uncertainty. And they bring with them a fear of the unknown and fears that go with potential loss of control. While we're in the thick of them, we can feel like we're on an emotional roller coaster. We kind of zoom up and down between feelings like excitement, anxiety, hope, doubt, grief. Like, it just take moving to a new place as an example. Well, that might be a really exciting idea, right? We bought a different house because we really liked it. We're moving from an apartment to a condo, and we're just stoked about it. And also, we don't really know how this is going to go, so that creates some uncertainty. Changing cities, like a bigger geographic change where we're leaving community behind, as well as changing spaces. We can be excited about where we're going and the opportunity. We can also feel disoriented and lonely, right? So all those things can be mixed up. Many of us probably feel at least somewhat familiar with the idea that the experience of grief can be considered as having stages. Again, I won't get into the particulars of that. It's often a misapplied idea. It's misunderstood in terms of its source. But it's a familiar idea. It's a popular idea. Stages of grief. Thank you, Kubler-Ross. I won't go too far down the rabbit hole there, except to observe that while an idea like that can be tremendously helpful, it can also be a problem, it can be disillusioning, if we treat that idea set as the only way to view something as complex and individual, multifaceted as grief, or if we think that an idea set like that means that our experience, to use the illustration of grief again, should be this tidy linear progression. Just no. That's just not how it works. But that doesn't mean the idea doesn't have something to offer us in terms of thinking about the complexity of what we're experiencing, right? Transitions and ideas about how transitions work can behave in a similar way. I want to introduce a particular model for the stages of transition, which I find helpful. I hope you will as well. And having said that, I also want to say that we should be careful not to take a model like this and try to slot all the pieces of our experience of transition into it with the attitude that if it's not tidy, it being our experience, there must be something wrong with us or something we're just missing about the model. That's reductionist. It's too simple. We need to keep complexity in here, and we need to keep uncertainty in here, among other things. The unknown, knowing that we don't know everything that's going on. Also, We're singling out transitions as though they were an isolated experience, and they're not. They happen in context, and the context can be really, really complex. However, not to dismiss all of that, but with it in view, here's a model. This is based on something called the William Bridges transition model. Again, I won't get into the weeds on the technical details because the internet, if you really want to know about this, and you didn't happen to make a quick note about what it was called just now, just ask me, then you can look it up. Short version is we can think of transitions as being caused by change, right? So the transition is one thing, change is another thing in this model. Transition is the experience we're having. Change is whatever is causing or sort of stirring up the transition, right? Putting us into a state of transition. Change is the external piece, if you will. Transition is the internal piece, right? So that's sort of the big framework. So we can think of transition as having three stages in this model. Starts with ending, which in the model is also called losing or letting go. And in that stage of transition, our central task as an individual is acknowledging what's being left behind. So we start by kind of going, yes, this includes loss. How many of you have ever seen, heard, encountered Jacinda, what's her last name, former Prime Minister of New Zealand, led them through COVID? Just has a new biography out that just landed on my desk earlier this week called A Different Kind of Power. I saw an interview with this person, and I was so struck by how she handled herself and ideas. I was just like, I don't have a lot of discretionary time, and some of it's going to this book. Just a lovely sort of nurturing brilliance about her as a leader. Oh, and also shortly after she took power, so COVID came along on the heels of that, and in the very early days of her leadership, there was a horrendous terrorist attack. 51, 52 Muslim folks gunned down, and like the way she managed that and the way the country responded collectively around dealing with automatic weapons. And like, there's just a bunch of things that the world looked at from a distance even over that time and went, well, that's a different way of approaching leadership and power.
I think she also had a baby.
She had two. Yes, she was, that's, and it's a big part of the story. Yes, kind of, can you be a mother? And this is a great shot of her and her partner and their two kids in the UN General Assembly in one of those meetings, right? And they're all there. It's just, anyway, there's also a brand new documentary, either just out or coming out, that tells that story. She talks in her autobiography, long way around, but she talks about the part of her life where she realized that her faith, her personal religious beliefs were changing, and she had left the church and she wasn't going back. And how grievous that was. It was the right choice for her and so on, but that sense of grief and of loss is the reason I wanted to mention that story here. So in stage one, losing, letting go, our main job is acknowledging what's being left behind. If we deny that, we're already in trouble in terms of being able to thrive in transition. Just because we're leaving something behind, and even know we need to, does not mean it is not precious. We don't have to be dismissive to leave something behind, even in terms of beliefs. And I think that's really important from a belief perspective. So that's stage one. Second stage is the neutral zone, aware of the uncertainty and discomfort of being in between. So this is a zone where we're especially aware of that feeling of, I'm going to call it liminal experience. So liminal, the fancy word that just means neither here nor there. If you want to think about it in terms of structure, a liminal space is like if you're leaving one room and you're going to another, and you're kind of like, right, as you're stepping over the threshold, you're not fully in this room and you're not fully yet in that room. That's a liminal space, right? It's an in-between space. So in this model for transition, that's the space where we're like, oh yeah, I'm neither fish nor fowl here. I'm in transition, and I'm neither that nor this. So that's the middle stage. And then the third stage is new beginnings, so we start to embrace a new chapter of possibilities. So one of the things I like about this model is that it helps me imagine transitions as transformative. They're disruptive, but that doesn't mean they're not productive, right? And I think that's really important. Acknowledging that transitions can be transformative doesn't tend to be my personal default setting. For me, getting stuck in the neutral zone is a real possibility. I find it reassuring that Susan Bridges, of William Bridges Associates, she's an expert in this model, she says it this way. She says, quote, "The essence of life takes place in the neutral zone phase of transition." Thank you, Susan. It is in that interim spaciousness. Okay, let's hold it right there. Interim spaciousness. I'm floating around untethered. This isn't feeling spacious. It's feeling adrift. But her perspective is that's about possibilities, right? And that's a really important perspective. It is in that interim spaciousness that all possibilities, creativity, and innovative ideas can come to life and flourish. No change without disruption. No growth without transitions. So many reasons why we might find this space difficult or uncomfortable. Those of us who have a higher orientation to control are just sort of by default likely to like this space less. Those of us who are inclined to blue sky creativity and everything is possible might just really kind of love this space and want to be in it all the time, to the discontent and disconcertation of the control people around us perhaps as well, the collision, right? So the way the model's structured, though, for me to make the most of transitions, as much as I might like that space, I also need to move through that zone and I need to move into embracing what might be possible. All right, so with that in view, I said in the blurb that we would dooby-dooby-do. So I want us to get practical here, consider what we might need to do to make the most of transition experiences, and then we'll take a look at the B part another day. So what I'm going to do is move through quite a few ideas here in a short period of time. So I want to suggest just listen for what's for you and like let the rest go by. Just reach out and snag the thing that gets your attention and think about that. So what do we need to do to make the most of transition experiences? These are going to sound like tropes, and I think they quite reasonably start there, but we don't need to stop there. So the first one is cultivate patience. So remembering that we're sort of hardwired to steer clear of things that are difficult or signal danger to us, this is where we kind of come eyeball to eyeball with that. Transitions often take time, and if we rush through or we make our central goal to avoid the discomfort, then we might be shortchanging ourselves when it comes to the possibility of growth. Now, acute discomfort or, you know, dangerous discomfort, like there's a continuum here, so keep that in mind, right? In terms of strategies that can help, it's important to do things like setting realistic expectations for ourselves and for others, where that might legitimately be our work to assist or support or guide that process. It's also important to avoid the pressure to figure it all out immediately. And in a world of instant, we are surrounded by the notion that there should be a quick fix for everything. And that's just a dangerous, incomplete idea. It's logical that it's present to us because we're surrounded by it. Marketers love it. So that's the first one. Embrace flexibility. The ability to pivot. So help me, I apologize for using a worn and weary word, but I think still potentially a helpful image, the ability to adapt, which is one of our greatest human strengths, the ability to let go of rigid plans. If we're going to thrive in transition, that stuff's essential. So for this one, I think that the Buddha actually kind of nailed this. We cause ourselves a lot of suffering by not being willing to release our grip on our plans and our belief about how things should be and what we think matters to us. And this is where staying focused on what's within our control, in contrast to what is less or not within our control, becomes an essential skill, and where practices like mindfulness of staying present to the moment, not judging the things that are coming into our mind, but just acknowledging them, giving them space, those things can be really helpful. Within the Christian tradition that I grew up in, the version of it I grew up in, someone probably at this point would have talked about waiting on God. Same thing, different meaning-making story framing it. That whole sort of mythology of, I remember coming downstairs for breakfast and my dad was sitting in the chair with his Bible open in his lap, and he did that every morning for an hour, and right, that whole thing. Listen, let me just take this to the edge, okay? Let's say there is no God. And those texts are the record of people trying to imagine one where there isn't one. Sitting there believing that there is a God with that text open for your consideration for an hour every morning is life-changing, even if there's no God. Like, it just, the good things are going to happen if you park your life and think about big questions in context. Like, that's just good work, period. Now, that's setting aside all of the other things that sort of trail after that, or precede it for that matter, in the realm of faith. So that's important stuff to remember. There's value in this across a real spectrum of experiences. So that's the second one. Third one is seek support. I mean, this is a rhetorical question, but what I wrote in my notes is just, where did we get this absurd idea that we should be able to do this by ourselves? What utter nonsense. I try not to say categoric things like that very often, but that one qualifies. We are, among other things, we are herd animals. Where did this notion that we can do it all ourselves? I mean, that's a complicated question. We won't all answer it the same. But however we parse this, if we want to do what is most helpful when it comes to thriving in transition, then reaching out to whether that's trusted friends or mentors or caring professionals, all of those things can help us ease the emotional burden. Be careful of AI. To our earlier conversation. Because a good chatbot is going to really sound like an empathetic human being. And it's going to feel good. Is that without value? No, that's not without value. But we need to remember where we are and who we are and are not with when we do that stuff. And this is going way back as a reference, but as I remember it, second Crocodile Dundee movie? Anyone? Am I alone? Are you with me? Second Crocodile Dundee movie, there's this moment where the urban character, the New Yorker, says something to Dundee about seeing a therapist, and Dundee says, "That's what me mates are for." Anybody else remember this moment? I think it's the same scene where he's shaving with his Bowie knife ostensibly. Anyway, our networks aren't going to all look the same is the point, but to do as well as we can in transition, we need to build a support network of people who understand what we're going through, who can offer practical advice and support. And it's not, this network needs to not just be people who get me. That's important, obviously, but also people who can zoom out and who can help me understand or consider what I'm dealing with or experiencing from other perspectives. That's really important. Trust, obviously, is a big component here. It's also important to remember that a robust network is multifaceted, and it doesn't all depend on one person or one relationship. For instance, this idea like you complete me, this is where, you know, a movie trope, this is where it reveals its downside. Wise friend once said to me about that idea in the context of romantic relationships, "I don't think any relationship should have to bear that burden." Yeah, that's fair. So that's not just true about romantic relationships or friendships. It's just true in also more formal or caring or supportive relationships. Fourth one, take small, conscious steps. One of the paralyzing problems of transitions can be overwhelm, and breaking a transition down into smaller, more manageable pieces can help prevent that. We've already talked about this, but whatever we're facing, we don't need to figure it all out immediately. That's just not a requirement, as much as we might feel like it. We might have a strong sense of urgency, but generally speaking, figuring it out immediately is not even truly an available option. I know that it's a trope as well as a TV series title, I think, at this point, but small achievable goals can actually keep us moving when big ultimate solutions might just stall us right out. It's okay to break it down. And there will be a little voice in some of our heads that says, "Wimp." When we do that with a big challenge, you know, you're gonna go for a 5-minute walk, are you? While the world burns? Good for you. Yes, good for you. Go for the walk. Practice self-care. I just want to say a couple of quick things about this. Again, a bit of a trope, but for a good reason. When we're dealing with transitions, we need to do what we can to prioritize our physical and our mental well-being. Easier said than done. Absolutely, it is. The reason it matters is because transitions can be incredibly draining, and so taking care of ourselves is crucial. It's sort of that whole put the oxygen mask on yourself first idea. Obvious examples are things like exercise, healthy eating, getting enough rest, choosing activities that bring joy. I go through the list quickly because we're aware. If you're in the middle of challenging transitions right now, a list like that could just be an immediate eye roll. Like, honestly, who feels like that's what's ready to hand when we're just trying to get our next breath? They sound like luxuries. But really, in a lot of ways, for many of us, those are the first things that go missing in transition as well, right? And there could be all kinds of reasons for that. But let's circle back. We don't need to figure it all out immediately. And honestly, it's getting started that leads to keeping going. That's pretty tidy again, right? But it's also true. I kind of like when it comes to exercise, that whole everything counts idea. Now, that can keep me on the couch. You know, this is exercise, the remote. Like, there's a degree at which it just all fails. But anyway, so we got to use a little bit of honesty and a little bit of reason there. But getting started matters. Take 2 minutes to just breathe. Come to the table. We'll make time to just be still. And I know "come to the table" is a short sentence for "I had to get dressed and get out of the house, never mind getting out of bed," right? Like, there's a bunch of things that precede just showing up. Walk around the block, or if you're able, walk across the room. You know, like, just a little bit of keep moving, right? Whatever that looks like. And as long as I'm talking about the table, there's a part of this idea that can easily get lost in the language of self-care. I mentioned it earlier, we're herd animals. We only survived as a species because we figured out how to help one another. Doesn't mean we're all extroverts, goodness no, but we do all need others. So self-care and isolation comes up really short as an idea in some significant ways. We're living in a time and a place where the ways of addressing that whole list without ever interacting meaningfully with another person are increasingly possible, but we are actually profoundly connected and we actually need one another. Even if we don't especially like one another. Which makes it more complicated, doesn't it? But this is one of the reasons why I keep banging away at an idea like around this community, like come out in person if you can. We don't thrive alone, including when we're in times of transition. And maybe especially when we're in times of transition. All right, one more and then we're going to leave it there for today. Last one is reframe the narrative. First stage of ending and letting go is important. We need to name and acknowledge what's being left behind, and much of what we're leaving behind can be so good, it can be so difficult to lose. Even if we're transitioning in something by choice, we might still be leaving behind things that feel good to us and that matter to us. So reframing is not something to rush into. Acknowledging what we're letting go of is part of authentically, honestly doing the work of that stage. This might have already been buried in other ideas, but you might recall that when we set out to say what we need to do to thrive in transition, step number one was cultivate patience. So this comes back to that. Maybe we can picture this as like doing a renovation project, which usually starts with some demolition. You got to kind of take apart something that's there a lot of the time. Just resurfaced a small deck in our yard, and the demolition took longer than the restructuring, right? So it can be like that. We might just want to rush it on and put a shiny coat of fresh paint over the thing and just make it pretty, but if we don't do that essential foundational work of clearing away what's already there, whatever the thing is that needs to be dealt with, and getting down to the sound essentials, the foundation of things, then whatever we put on top of it quite possibly won't actually be better. It might look better, but it really might just be slapping a glossy exterior over the problem. So we need to start by acknowledging what we're losing. And it's important that we don't stay there. And reframing can help us with this. It can help us focus on what we might gain or what we might learn from the experience rather than just focusing on what we're losing. So and, really important word in there. And again, this isn't a denial. So reframing is not a denial of what we're losing in this model. We start with acknowledgement and we move from there to other possibilities. Are the challenges real? Absolutely. Are they daunting? Yes. Are they also potentially possibilities and opportunities to grow? Yes. Intelligence, says Heraclitus, is the ability to change. And that includes our ability to change our perspective on what we're going through. Let me just bring this home. I feel like here at the table, this physical room that we're in and the virtual rooms that are part of our community are often populated with people in transition, and in particular with people whose beliefs are in transition. The events, the changes in our model that set those transition into motion are as varied as the people are, but what many of us have in common is that we're exploring what we believe. We're in transition around our beliefs, and if we as a community do as good a job as we're able of what we're here to do, one of the outcomes, I believe, can be making a safer space in which to do that work, a space where we can be patient with ourselves and with one another, a space where we can let go of rigid beliefs if that's what we need to do, where we can experiment with possible adaptations, where we can support one another, where we can break the sometimes all or nothing feelings or ideas down to smaller, more manageable ones, where we can experience some aspects of self-care in the context of other care, and where we can truly consider what good possibilities might come from whatever transition it is that we are in. That's all I'm going to say about that for now. There's lots of ideas in there. When we return to the topic, we'll consider something about the B part of do be do be do be. And until then, peace.